Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response midday for the 29th of Kislev. And today, I know I've been speaking about it the whole holiday, but today finally I remembered to look up the 5th of Chanukah, not just the 29th of Kislev. And I found two tshuvot, two short, brief responses of the Sri De'esh of Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, and that's what I'm going to be using today. And they seem to have a little bit of a common theme. So in Sri De'esh, volume 1, response number 10, Vav, response number 15, from the 5th of Chanukah of Tafshid Chaf of 1959, I assume. It was actually the 30th of December of 1959. I just looked it up, so it's one day actually later than you're listening to this now, which is the 29th of December, one day in the English calendar later. So that's of 1959. Sri De'esh was asked about whether one could read the Torah in a shul that didn't have the Bima Ba'emtza. So this is an issue that I did not learn about until I was relatively old. I grew up in many places, but the last of them was Flatbush, and I never heard that it was an issue. Now, thinking back, the shuls that I went to pretty much all had their Bima Ba'emtza, meaning that central table where the Torah is read being somewhere in the middle of the shul. When I got to the west side of Manhattan after I got married, and I eventually became the assistant rabbi at the Jewish Center for a year, there was a place where the Bima wasn't Ba'emtza. The table where the Torah was read is way in the front of the shul, and I met people who were very upset about it and were concerned about it. And this tshuva is a reminder of the issues there. So a man turns to the Sri De'esh, who's now a 74-year-old man, and he says, am I allowed to read the Torah? I think he had a job maybe, or he was volunteering, but he was going to read the Torah for the community in a shul, and the shul didn't have Bima Ba'emtza. And he says also, how do people back in Berlin handle this situation? So we're going to see that part of the challenge of Bima Ba'emtza was that one of the things that the Reform did when they started changing things in the shuls was they changed the Bima to be from the middle of the shul to the front of the shul, and that was part of what people objected to about it, because it had a connection reform. Today is going to raise that issue. He says, I don't know what happened in Berlin, because in Berlin, he said, the only people who changed, the only shuls that changed the Bima from the middle, the table where you'd read the Torah from the middle of the shul to the front or to someplace else, were the Reform, were the, he calls them the Chofshiyim, the people who had thrown off the yoke of true Torah and mitzvos, and they also had an organ in their shul, and they had it on Shabbos and Yom Tov, and they had a choir of women singing. So in all these kinds of shuls, the giants of the generation said you couldn't daven there at all. But that was a combination of a bunch of factors. There were many, many things going wrong. There was a violation of Shabbos in playing an organ on Shabbos. There was Kol Be'ish having women singing in public. Singing in public is an interesting issue for him to raise, because he elsewhere allowed women to sing together with men in educational settings, although I think people have quoted it as, and he wasn't so careful, he didn't care so much about Kol Isha, but it's not true. Kol Isha, women, just a choir of women singing in public was a problem. And then there's Kukot HaGoyim, as we saw yesterday. He was worried about that in terms of an organ, in even in the dedication of a cemetery, let alone in a shul. And so that whole idea to want that whole, all of that together creates a picture of people who want to really mix with the non-Jews around them and become one with them and to join them. That's an issue on which one could say a lot about the extent to which Jews come to feel more part of the country in which they're living than they do as a connection to the Jewish heritage, and wanting to be fully a part of that society in terms of being totally considered a part of it and have a share in it. In any case, different topic. But he says, so it comes, if you can give me a shul that doesn't have an organ, and they don't have a woman choir singing in public to the men as well, and the only thing that's a problem is they don't have the Bima Ba'emtza, so that's a question. So he's not sure. So he couldn't tell you from the practice in Berlin what happened. He points out the Rambam in the Laws of Davening, in Hilchot Tefillah, the 11th chapter, Halacha Gimel says, we put a Bima in the middle of the Bayit, in the middle of the Shul. And the Rambam writes, Kidei Sheyishmeu Kulam, so that everybody can hear. Because the Mishnah there says it's not an obligation. It would depend on that time and that place what it is. Meaning, let's say I have a very small shul, and to put the Bima in the middle would take up so many seats that it would be a challenge for getting people the seats that they need. Whereas there's a stage in the front that's convenient not to have, that there's no real seats there anyway, and I put the table up there, and everybody can hear because it's small enough. So the Kesef Mishnah doesn't seem to have such a terrible problem with it. But in the Shulchan Aruch, The Sri Deish points out, he doesn't mention it because, as far as the Kesef Mishnah and who wrote the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo, was concerned, it wasn't an absolute requirement. It was a practice, and it was a practice for the goal of being able, everybody being able to hear the Torah reading when it was read. But that's a goal that could be met perhaps in other ways. It wasn't an ideological factor of the Bima should be in the middle. Whereas the Ramah, in Or HaChaim Kuf Nun, 150, paragraph 5, quotes the Rambam specifically. And that has its source, people have pointed out before the Sri Deish, that has its source in the Gemara in Sukkah, and also Yerushalmi in Sukkah. It's also a Zohar, and the Chasam Sofer in Or HaChaim Simon Chaf Chet had a long discussion of why it's prohibited not to have the Bima. By putting the Bima anywhere else would be prohibited, and the Netziv followed, others. And so if you have a Bima in the middle, says the Sri Deish, then you're not allowed to change it because that's the custom. And changing a custom that has been, especially a custom that has lasted many generations, that's completely prohibited. And if you look at the Maharam Shik, who we saw quoted yesterday by David Zvi Hoffman as his Rebbe, the Maharam Shik writes that even a Bima, even just moving the Bima, making it not in the middle of the shul, that's kukot agoyim. That is an unacceptable imitation of the non-Jewish nations. So all of that would seem to say that you have to have a Bima be'emtza. Certainly a place where you traditionally have the Bima be'emtza, it becomes a minhag. So that's an interesting thing to think about. Meaning, if the Ramah quotes the Rambam, it says it's because of helping everybody hear. So then if you have a custom that only applies in certain circumstances, when circumstances change, what do you do about that? We're going to see a tshuva about that in the month of Tevet. But where do you and don't you allow customs to change as circumstances change? Here, it's more problematic because in general, the custom would change out of a desire to imitate other things. But that becomes the question, and that's how some shuls might decide to be able to allow themselves to build in a way that wouldn't have to be able to answer, even though they don't mean to be imitating the non-Jews, and even though they don't mean to be joining with the reform. Okay, so, in our situation, the Maram Shik and others seem to say, therefore the Chasam Sofer seem to say, you have to have Bima Be'emtza. So even if that's true, says the Sri Deish, he doesn't know that it makes it prohibited to daven there, right? You can have a shul that does something wrong, and it's not the right way to do it, but it's not so problematic an issue, so severe a transgression, so severe a violation, that we would say you can't daven there, and especially to say that you wouldn't be allowed to read the Torah for the community. Meaning if this man is going to read the Torah for the community, he's going to be helping them learn Torah. And the fact that they happen to have built a shul, and as far as we're talking, they're an Orthodox shul, and they don't care about any of that reform stuff. They're not interested in that. They're not trying to imitate any churches down the street or anything like that. It just happened to be they built the Bima in the wrong place, and that's wrong, and maybe it shouldn't be happening that way. But to say from there that you can't read the Torah in a shul like that, he thinks the Sri Deish's first instinct is that the mitzvah is to help the community by reading the Torah for them so that they can come and learn Torah and daven with the community and benefit. And the problem, says the Sri Deish, is the people who built the shul and the gabayim and the people responsible for making the decisions, they did the wrong thing, but you don't punish the whole community for it. That's a topic I feel like we've seen before. I think it was Rav Kook last time who was talking to a rabbi who wanted to punish a whole community for having given Maftir Yonah to a guy who went to work and ate on Yom Kippur but bought Maftir Yonah. So there too I pointed out that the question of who we assign responsibility to is for is always an interesting one. Meaning if these are people who came after the shul was built, then it's hard to blame them. They happen to move into the neighborhood, this is their shul, and they in a shul that happens to be the bima was built in the wrong place. But there are other situations where that's not what's going on, where they also didn't care about Bima Be'emtza. In any case, that's where the Sri Deish has it. He says he's never heard anybody who said, you can't daven in a shul where there's no Bima, where the Bima has been put in a place other than the middle. Then you have the notes, meaning Sri Deish writes a letter, and then when he comes to publish it, he reviews it, and sometimes he throws in a new idea that he thought of. We've seen this before in other tshuvot. So here, he throws in that by now, when he's publishing this already, when he's going over for publication, he heard that in Hungary, in fact, the rabbis had said that Bima Be'emtza, the having the Bima in the middle, was such a serious issue that you couldn't go into a shul that didn't have Bima in the middle. Says the Sri Deish, That was, however, at a time when there was still the war against assimilation, against reform. I mean, it was a battle. It was a struggle, too. It was hard to imagine that Orthodoxy was going to survive because reform was really ascendant, and they were winning, winning, winning. So that the rabbis Hungary said that is fully understandable, and if you had been in Hungary at the time, clearly you would have had to partake of that. You would have had to refrain, therefore, from going into a shul like that. But because that was one of the first signs of joining the reform, of assimilating, of all these terrible things. But in a place where that's not true anymore, so this is already 1959 in a completely different social setting, it's a shul that happens to be built without a bima, with the bima in the wrong place. Sri Deish doesn't think that it applies. He adds that while he hadn't known about Berlin, he did know of a city called Kybartė, which is still a city in Lithuania on the border with Germany. There they had a shul, and the bima was up near, in the front, near the Aron Kodesh, like I've seen other shuls. So in Kybartė, they built the shul with the bima in the wrong place. And the rabbis of the place weren't happy about it. But he doesn't know of anybody who said that they shouldn't daven there, and that if people happened to be in the neighborhood, and that was the shul that was around, they would daven there, and that's what they did. So today he advises this man, he says, but if you want to sort of not just give into this and not just make it that it's perfectly fine to do this, his advice would be that he or any other Baal Koreh should make sure that they don't daven there all the time. They daven there sometimes, and when they're asked why they can't be there all the time, they say, I have a problem with it because you have a beam of, you don't have the beam of Amsa, and it's a problem. But if it's an issue of stopping a community from being able to daven, that he says, Chas v'Shalom, we shouldn't do such a thing. So that's our first tshuva for the fifth day of Hanukkah from the 29th of Kislev of Tavshin Chaf. 3 years later, which was a few days earlier in December, so we're still in not, if even though it's Tavshin Chaf Gimel, we're in 1962, Sri Deish was asked about a couple of things. He calls the tshuva Ner Chanukah Lamala Mikaf Amot, when you have a Chanukah candle above 20 amot high, like in a house, a multi-story building or dwelling, and other things. But the truth is, he spends most of his time on the other things. So the first thing he brings up, and he deals with it very briefly, this is from the first volume of Sri Deish, Sima Nun Zion, the 57th responsum, it's on Kufkov Zion, page 167. He says, let's say you live on the fifth floor, which is higher than 20 amot. The reason why higher than 20 amot is a problem is, let's say I put my candles in the window. The assumption in the time of Chazal was that above 20 amot, people don't look and don't see. So that's the assumption of this response in this tshuva. What do you do about it? I think today you might argue that people have become more accustomed to looking up higher, and therefore maybe those standards aren't quite the same. But in any case, those are going to be the assumptions for our discussion in this tshuva. So the Sri Deish says it's clear to him, as the Pri Chadash had written, that, and is quoted in other things as well, that you put the candles in your doorway. Now, here, I think that the doorway is facing outside as well. So it would be like sort of a building where you have a porch outside your doorway. Meaning, usually in apartment buildings, doorways are inside the building, inside the hallway. But he seems to be talking about a place where the doorway is outside or faces outside. So it could be, there are buildings where your front door is outside, like, but I don't know, five-story buildings like this where you go downstairs from your front doorway and the stairs are outside. But it's not common. In any case, let's assume that that's true. He says you should put the door and the candles in your doorway. He says even in Eretz Yisrael, in the land of Israel, where people are going back to putting, so we generally don't put candles in our doorways anymore for various reasons. One is that outside it's windy and they'll blow out, so you can get a glass thing like they do in Eretz Israel. But people have, I think, probably a leftover from Europe where it was often very dangerous to have your candles outside because people would persecute you, non-Jews would persecute you for having candles outside, so the custom became to put them inside. And then once they were being put inside, they were even often put on an inside table where nobody outside the family could see them, and the Pirsum and Nisa was only within the family. Nowadays, many people try to put them in a window where people from the street can see them because there's no problem with persecution. But the Sri Deish is saying you really should put them just in your doorway. And that narrative, so also you'd put them in your doorway, or even if you have a front yard, so your doorway isn't on the street, then if you could put them right at the street, that would be even better. So in Israel, we have the permission and the right to perform the mitzvah properly and appropriately, then we should. But if you're living on the fifth floor and you can't put them in the doorway to the courtyard, in the doorway to the front yard, then you put them in the opening to your house. That's what he holds. So that's you know, relatively minor part of the tshuva, even though that's what he gave the reason, the name of the tshuva for it. But then he gets to another issue, a different issue, that he goes on for at much greater length. The man who had asked him this question, it was some kol boy in Punovich. So, or man, maybe. So that's why he talks about what's going on in Eretz Yisrael and think it's clear you have to put it in the front of your doorway. So the second question this kol guy had asked him was, let's say you have a business and you have an employee and you want to test your employee's honesty. So the way you're thinking of testing your employee's honesty is by leaving a certain amount of money in, you know, an open area of the business, and to see if this guy takes it or announces, I found some lost money. So can you do that? What's the other issues of doing that? So three the H says, first thing is, there's a Gemara Bava Metzia that says that if somebody lends money to somebody else without witnesses, right, it's a private transaction. The Gemara Bava Metzia on Daif Ayin Hey Amud Bet says you're over Mishum Lifnei Iver. You're transgressing Lifnei Iver. You're luring this poor person, this man, this person who borrows the money from you into sin. How? Because if you go and adds, if you go in klala la'atzo and cause curse to yourself for having done this. So what's the problem? So Rashi there says, because shelo ole al ruko shelove lichpor, because it sort of causes the borrower to think, maybe I can get away with denying it. And if I can get away with denying it, maybe that's what I should do. So that's cited in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. That would seem to imply that any situation where I set somebody else up and I give them an easy opportunity to not do the right thing, that's a problem. We shouldn't be doing that. That's included in Lifnei Iver. And so too, in Kiddushin Lamed Bet, Amud Aleph, Rav Huna, there's a story about Rav Huna tearing things in front of his son. And in the Gemara, he says, I'm going to see if he gets angry with me, if it angers him, and I'm going to test whether he's able to control himself, whether he's gotten rid of or able to suppress or taught himself not to get angry about things, because anger is seen as a very terrible character trait in Jewish thought. So the Gemara says, maybe he'll get angry. So if he will get angry, and being angry is a problem, then Rav Huna has just led his son astray. And the Gemara explicitly says, isn't Rav Huna therefore transgressing Lifnei Iver? And so they say, because in that case, if he gets angry, he's going to get angry with his father and maybe mistreat his father in that situation. And he's causing him to violate the proper kibud, kavod, or yira, kavod, or mora, the proper honor or fear or awe that one is supposed to have for a parent. And they, therefore, they say, Umishane de mochile, that Rav Huna said, I'm mochel. Even if he mistreats me, it's not going to be a sin because I'm mochel. So it sounds, though, like it's still a question of Lifnei Iver, of a Lifnei Iver problem. It would have been, if you're not for the fact that even mochel, there would have been a Lifnei Iver problem. So according to that, it would seem like in our situation as well. If you leave money out for the employee and it turns out he's not as honest as we'd like him to be, and he takes the money rather than announcing he found some lost money, isn't the balabayit, isn't the owner of the business, violating Lifnei Iver? So you say, well, his way around it is he can be mafkir it. He can declare the money no longer his, and if he's mafkir the money, now, when the man takes it, it's nobody's money, and therefore it's not a Kenev Ish, it's not a Lifnei Iver. So the Sefer says, but I don't understand that. I don't think so, because Lifnei Iver would still apply. Why? Because he says, Tosos there say, Tosos on the story about Rav Huna and his son, Rabbah, Tosos say that it must be that Rav Huna also told Rabbah ahead of time what he was planning on doing, because if not, or told him that he's Mochel. You see, we have to look up Tosos together, saying, neglected to do, but so I just did look it up, hitting the pause button on the recorder, and Tosus doesn't make it clear. I think you have to, Tosus has to mean that he told him that he's mochel if he gets angry with him, not that he told him that he's mochel, that he's going to tear stuff up to test whether he gets angry, because I would think if somebody told you, I'm tearing this now to test whether you get angry, that you'd be, that it wouldn't show anything, because whether you got angry or not, you know the test is coming. So how is that a test of anything? I think it must mean that he told him he's mochel ahead of time if he reacts badly to him. In any case, Tosos' reasoning is, that's why Sudeh brings it up, Tosos' reasoning is that if I didn't tell him ahead of time, then if the son gets angry, if Rabbah gets angry at his father and mistreats his father, so even though it's true that it's not a sin because the father was mochel, Rabbah thought he was committing a sin, and that's called being mitkaven le'echol besar chazir ve'ala biyadot tles. Somebody thinks they're going to eat pork, and they end up eating kosher meat. Right? So it's not a sin in the technical sense of you didn't eat pork, but you still need mechila v'kapara. You still need atonement, and you need to be absolved of your intent to sin. So if that's true, then that would still be a leaf the iver problem, Tosfot is implying, and the Sri Deish is saying. So here too, even if you told me that the owner was mafkir the money, so it's not theft, the guy who, the employee, if he takes it without saying, I found some lost money, would be exactly that. He'd be thinking he was doing something wrong, even though it ended up that he wouldn't be, and that should be a lifnei iver issue. And in this case, he can't tell him ahead of time, because if he tells him ahead of time, it'll completely ruin the destroy the test. Meaning, in the case of Rehuna and his son, I think if he just told them, listen, I want you to know that I am mochel you, I understand sometimes you get angry, sometimes not, and I'm mochel if you get angry, so that could solve the problem, then he could tear the clothing or the expensive items, and it would test whether he gets angry or not, because the test isn't whether he'll get angry at his father, even though he knows it's wrong, it's just whether he'll get angry at all, just because it's testing whether he's the kind of person who's not yet in control of his temper, was where Rehuna was testing. So there, if he says to him, listen, if you get angry with me, it's not a violation of Kibbutz Av Va'em, because that's not what he was testing, so then the test could still be valid, because it's testing his anger, his qualities of anger. But if I'm testing whether the employee will take something that doesn't belong to him, and I say to him, I'm being mafkir, then it's not, there's no way, it's not a test. Yet, the lifting iver issue is still not quite so obvious and clear, because in the case of lending money without witnesses, what we said was that was a lifting iver problem, because I'm giving the lender is giving the borrower the opportunity to sin, because he can just deny that he ever had a loan, and it's that opportunity to sin that we don't want to create. That's the problem with neighbors. So the commission says, I don't understand that reasoning, though, because even if the lender lends the money with witnesses, the borrower is not required to get those witnesses together to pay back the lender. If that's true, then the borrower could say, yeah, I borrowed, but I paid it back. And the fact that there were witnesses at the original lending, the original loan, doesn't help with that. So why is there a lifnei iver issue? So the Lechem Mishnah's answer was that when Rashi said, he might think to deny it, it doesn't mean we're talking about evildoers. In halacha, very often we'll say, the Gemara will say, and the Halacha Mishnah uses this phrase, atu b'rishiyaskina, no, we're talking about, you know, criminals, terrible people. We don't mean that. If we meant that, that would be a whole different kind of a problem. Belief in the Iverish is not, you have to worry that this lender, this borrower, will just decide to, oh, I can get away with it because you didn't have witnesses here. We're talking about ordinary, regular people. Ordinary, regular people, we assume if they borrow money from somebody, they intend to pay it back. What we mean is, the Lecha Mishnah says, when Rashi says, Rashi said, ole al l'rucho lichpor, so I'm not saying the Lecha Mishnah is the obvious way to read Rashi. Rashi seems to imply that it really tempts him into denying it. Now, I would say, for the Lecha Mishnah, another way to answer the Lecha Mishnah's question is you could say that the rabbi would tell you, it's true, he can claim he gave it back, but at least if I've got witnesses who saw that I made the loan, it make it more official, and that'll be less. It'll be more of a stretch for him to find a way to deny it, to say he paid it back. And since it's more of a stretch, it's less likely they'll do it. And it's, I'm doing my job in helping him not give in to his baser self. It's true, he can still find a way to deny the loan, but I, the lender, will not have been part of creating that circumstance. What I could have imagined answer for the Lecha Mishnah. The Lecha Mishnah has a different answer that the Sri Deish is going to build off of. So the Lecha Mishnah's answer is, we're worried that he'll forget, and then he'll deny it. Meaning he'll deny it, not because he knows about the loan and just means to cheat the lender. It's because the borrower will have forgotten the loan, and when the borrower then swears that he never borrowed money, the borrower, from his or her perspective, will be telling the truth. Right? And that's the leaf the iver problem, that we are allowing the possibility, the Lecha Mishnah says, that we're allowing the possibility that this borrower will come to truly believe that he doesn't owe money or she doesn't owe money to the lender, and that's where we're going wrong. Now, that doesn't, I don't think it quite fits Rashi, because Rashi speaks about being lichpor, denying it when you know what it is, but that's the way the Lecha Mishnah reads it. The reason that helps the Sri Deish is because he says in our situation, you wouldn't have that problem. If the holy thing are there, is only the worry that you first might forget, but we're not talking about Rishaim, then here there wouldn't be the thing there, because if we assume we're not talking about Rishaim, then I can leave money lying around, and the person, I can expect the person will generally give it back, because people are generally honest, and it's not a thing of your issue. Except that Sri Deish has another reason the commissioner might not be right. He might say that even if it's true that the borrower could still deny the loan by saying, I paid you back already. Once there are witnesses, as I think I hinted before, once there are witnesses, he won't do, the borrower is less likely to do it because more people know that he's lying. They don't. The witnesses won't know that he's lying because maybe he did pay it back even without witnesses, but it's more of a real situation that he's trying to get out of, and therefore it's less likely that he will deny it. And the Tumim had written something along those lines. He had said that if there are no witnesses, he can say, I don't know if I owe you any money, and then it'll be patur. But if there are witnesses, he can't just say, I don't know, because they'll say, if you don't know, then you owe it, because we've got these witnesses that said you borrowed it. So therefore, you have, so it helps him not get into that situation. It helps make it harder for the borrower to find ways to tell himself it's okay to sort of not pay what he should be paying. So fundamentally, then, the Sri Deish comes down to the side of that maybe it's not a lifnei yevir issue. It's not a lifnei yevir issue because we don't assume we're dealing with evildoers, and this person doesn't know, knows that it's not his, and therefore we don't have a reason to think that he's going to just take it. And the whole thing about lending money without witnesses was only was specific to the loan issue, because in the loan issue, he might end up forgetting, or he might end up not being as not being as clear that people know that he's doing the wrong thing, and therefore there might be a different issue over there. Another reason he says that you can allow doing this in the situation he thinks is that the Gemara of Avodah Zarah says that a man can tell his workers, here's money, go and buy yourselves food and eat. He doesn't have to worry that they're going to buy food that's not allowed to them. They're going to buy Shemitah food, or they're going to buy Maaseh that's not really theirs. So the Ritva there says, isn't that Lifnei Iver? Because maybe they'll go and they'll buy the wrong food. Meaning, let's say you had workers you knew didn't keep kosher, would be a good sort of example in our times. And in those times, you owed your workers food. So let's say you say to your workers, go, here's the money. Go buy the food, and there's a McDonald's on the street, as well as a kosher restaurant on the street. You don't know your workers so well. So if it says, isn't that lifnei iver? Aren't you helping them maybe do the wrong thing? So the Ritva says that if you're not giving them something actively prohibited, kosher ain't notin lo isur, something that's itself prohibited, just you worry that the person will be able to take what you're doing and do and violate the Torah, the Ritva says that's not lifnei iver. So that's interesting because there's this famous tshuva of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach about giving a Jew food when you know they won't make a bracha. So Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, surprisingly to people, ruled that you were allowed to do that even though they weren't going to make a bracha, and it wasn't a problem with the Iver. So here you have a Ritva that says very much that. He says, as long as whatever I'm giving the person is permissible and the prohibition that the person might violate comes later, then that's not my responsibility, because lifting iver doesn't mean I have to make sure to stop somebody from doing a prohibition. It means I can't give them the vehicle of prohibition. So when I give them the money to buy food, the money is permissible. They can buy permissible food. If they choose to buy other food later that's not permissible, that's not something that I'm required to worry about, and that's not a lifnei iver issue. And for support, the Ritva points out there's a mission in Shvi'it which talks about whether or not you can sell a cow that pulls a plow in a Shemitah year. So Beit Shammah say you can't, because the reason that you buy a cow that pulls a plow is to pull a plow, and you're not allowed to plow your fields on a Shemitah year, so you're helping the person. Whereas Beit Hillel, and we tend to possibly like Beit Hillel, we tend to rule like Beit Hillel say you can sell it because maybe he wants to eat the cow. So even though I would use this cow for plowing, maybe the person buying it to eat, and I'm allowed to assume that. In other words, the cow itself is not a prohibited item, and therefore I'm allowed to do it, and that's what the Ritva uses to point out that that's how the lifnei iver works. And Ravashi in the Gemara of Avodah Zarah says also, wherever we can find ways to assume that people do the right thing, we're allowed to assume in general that people will do the right thing. So the A says, in our case, you're not even giving the person anything. You're leaving in a place where the person would is likely to find it. And nobody would think, says the Sri Deish, that And I think today some people might think it, but nobody would think it as a halachic matter, that let's say I leave my items where they don't belong, and don't belong, I mean, they're too open to being stolen, right? I leave my car with the door unlocked and the keys in the ignition. I do it for stupid reasons, but let's say I do it, or I do it on purpose. Let's say I do it to test people's honesty. Sridesh says nobody would think that's a leaf the Iver issue, so I think colloquially we might say you're leaving a stumbling block before the blind, but Sridesh is pointing out, in a halachic sense, it's my car, it's my keys, the fact that I leave it somewhere doesn't mean that it's a leaf the Iver to the other people, and therefore it's not a leaf the Iver issue. It points out like Warren Bamatia talks about that exactly. If somebody wants to, you know, get rid of their inheritance, right? They got a lot of money and they want to waste it. So he says, so do this, wear all this clothing that gets used up quickly and buy a lot of glass items because that'll break easily, and then have a lot of workers and don't watch over them because they'll steal from you and they won't work and they this and that. But nobody says it's lifting Iver problem, just saying it's a way to waste money. So lifting Iver, doesn't apply in those situations. There's one last little piece about why today we're allowed, or why today people tend to lend money without witnesses. But we'll leave that for another time because we're out of time. So our response of the day, we saw two responses of the Shri De'esh, somebody we don't always get such a chance to see. One response was about Bima Be'emtza, about the importance of putting the table from which you read the Torah in the middle of the shul, but that importance being largely in the context of the battle against reform, also in the context of having to keep minhagim, having to continue the customs of our forefathers, but does not lead, as far as he knows, to any particular reason you can't daven there, except for where the rabbis of Hungary said, no, you can't daven in such a shul, and therefore he thought it would be okay and permissible to read the Torah there, especially since that is a public service, and he should and could perform that public service. And then the second shuva, which had a very small, short one about Hanukkah, and that you put the menorah in your doorway if you can, and then a much longer discussion of what constitutes the behavior of where we are and aren't allowed to, where our actions are considered leading a fellow Jew astray, where we're not allowed to do such a thing. And those are a response of a day, response of a day for the 29th of Kislev, the 5th day of Hanukkah. Have a great day.